It's been a long time. Been a long time. Been a long, lonely, 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 lonely time.
Some things are better when they rock. Seminole Hard Rock Hotels and Casinos. Play 24/7 with nonstop casino action, rooms fit for the king, pool, spas, restaurants, and clubs for every taste and temptation. Been a long time since you rock and rolled? Visit us in Tampa or Hollywood, Florida, or online at SeminoleHardRock.com.
Little Steven's Underground Garage's coolest conversations, presented by Hard Rock Cafe, hosted by the Mighty Manfred.
This is the Mighty Manfred in Little Steven's Underground Garage, and it's time for your coolest conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock. Thanks for listening, and please remember to follow and subscribe, rate, and review. My guest today is 80s pop music icon Josie Cotton, who came to prominence in the decade early on with her song Johnny, Are You Queer? And fast forwarding to now, she supplied us with the coolest song in the world, Calling All Girls, is off her recently reissued album Pussycat Babylon. I'll play some of that now, followed by my interview with Josie on your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage. Mighty Manfred here with you in Little Steven's Underground Garage. And joining me for today's coolest conversations is 80s pop icon Josie Cotton, singer, songwriter, producer, who first came to prominence in the 1980s with her song Johnny, Are You Queer? And her tune Calling All Girls is this week's coolest song in the world. Hi, Josie. How are you?
Hey, Manfred. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm very excited to be chatting with you today. First, were you able to keep healthy over this past year and a half, almost 2 years?
I was in complete lockdown with my cat, so I did stay healthy though. I'm extremely lucky, as we both are, to be talking and still sitting up. So yeah, it was tricky. It's still tricky. I don't even know where this is going, but. You're just trying to be smart about it.
Well, right. In fact, during the lockdown time, was that productive for you creatively at all?
Well, it was productive in that I was able to do something I'd planned for a while, is to re-release on my catalog, record by record, like with a captive audience, pretty much. But that was great. I had to remove stuff from the internet and put it on my own label so that everything was in one place and there weren't strange people getting royalties that I've never met and whatnot in other parts of the world. So that was great. And then I got to do a lot of collaboration, remote. I did a duet with Ben of Screeching Weasel. That was really cool. And on their latest album, and I got to do, a song on this new Go-Go's tribute record on Sympathy. Like, it's a double album. It's kind of amazing. I'm sure you've heard a lot of that, those songs, from the Coolies and the 5678s. I mean, it's just like, it's a lot of girl power on that record. It's kind of crazy.
What is the Go-Go song that you cover? Because I actually, honestly, I haven't heard about it as a project.
You haven't heard about the project?
No.
Yeah, it's called Fading Fast. It's the number, it's the first song on the double album. So that was pretty, you know, that was an honor. And to be right up front like that. And yeah, it turned out, I was determined to make it different. I just didn't want to copy the Go-Go's. And so I made it kind of techno. You know, there's you know, it's very dark and strange. So that was my goal. And we accomplished that goal, I think. And so, yeah, so that happened. And then I've been finishing up my next record. And that's been kind of amazing. I got Clem Burke to, you know, he did come out and play. Once every, you know, things were, everyone was kind of vaccinated, I did start having real sessions, and Clem Burke came out and played on a couple of songs, which is amazing.
And now we're talking about Clem Burke, the drummer from Blondie.
Yeah.
And you're talking about him playing on new recording sessions?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
On
my new record. And yeah, you know, we've had some, I have a little recording studio with Paul Rossler, and then we have a lot of bands coming out, and it's, you know, tons of drummers. And Paul, I was sitting right next to Paul, and I've never seen a drummer twirl his drumsticks while in a recording session. He was just so on, and so, I mean, he was just so in it, and we were just amazed by his, you know, his absolute, like, you know, commitment to the moment he was in, and twirling the drumsticks like there was an audience, and we would look at each other and go, wow. It was crazy, but it was still a thing where we weren't shaking hands and we had on masks, you know, like he came to the studio, and then, you know, I brought him some water, and like that was, and we waved goodbye. And so I still haven't, I did actually get to, you know, see him for real. And we did one of these 80s shows. He was playing drums for the Romantics, I believe it was.
Right. And, yeah. He was filling in with them too recently.
Yeah. And so he's just the sweetest guy. And that was thrilling. And and Eddie Spaghetti played on another couple of tracks. And, on this record, you know, from what is that band that they're in? They're huge.
Oh, like, yeah. Super Suckers.
That's that. I suck. Okay. Super Suckers. Yeah. So he is awesome bass player. So that was really fun. And now I'm planning a video, and I don't know, I'm just trying to really stay busy. I'm veering you away from, I know you have a plan here. I can feel you have a schedule of questions. Go back.
Well, I certainly do, but right. You're touching on some things. I might come back to this. First, I just wanted to find out. So you're from Texas, right? From Dallas originally?
Yeah.
And did you grow up in Dallas?
Yeah. I mean, I was accidentally born in another state because my whole family, it was real Texan, and I was actually born in Missouri, which is odd. I have no memory of it. No one seems to know the town I was born in, so it must have been way up in the boondocks. But but Texas, yeah, that was my that was how I was reared, I guess you could say.
Well, so I read, or maybe I saw an interview where you were talking about being a dancer before a singer. What is your background in the arts?
In the arts. Well, you know, my stepdad, he was a ballet dancer, and they were married when I was like 1 year old. And so, and he started a ballet school in Dallas, Texas, which is hilarious when you think about it. But you know, there's some great eccentric people in Texas, and he was kind of a famous ballet dancer in his own right. But I basically was his captive prisoner, like growing in my childhood. I'd be there like 18 hours a day, you know, before I started school. And so I was dancing. By the time I was four, I was dancing in his ballet company and putting on shows, And he played music from all over the world. I really, you know, he had this record collection. I just remember being so influenced by, you know, all different cultures and you know, time capsules and I would make people, I would light candles and make everyone watch me run through the room with scarves. So they knew I was a complete ham early on. So, but you know, he was a huge influence. There was no artist in my family that I know of, you know, my mom's side, it's the only side I know. And, but he would say things like, there's no happiness, there's only art. And I was like 4 years old.
Oh, wow.
And I believed him. And that was the only advice I ever got, which is so crazy. They're so polite in Texas in my family. They just don't, you know, they don't like, you know, school you or, you know, correct you or, you know, raise you really. you just be pretty and nice. And he was just so intense. And so I thought, you know, okay, there's no happiness, only art. That means art will never make you happy. You could also come away with that. And so, but I took it, I guess, the right way. And it became like my thing I was living for at 4 years old. So just an odd, you know, relationship wow. with art early on.
Right. Well, so how did you transition from being a dancer? I mean, how active were you dancing? You said you're four. Does that carry on into your late teens?
Well, I mean, I was, by the time I was 12, I was in a ballet company. And, mm-hmm. When they divorced, I removed myself from that world and became really entranced by singing in choirs. I fell in love with singing with people and then I started took up the piano and I started writing songs when, you know, pretty early, like 9 years old. My first song was Meow Cat Boogie. It was just ridiculous, like unbelievable. So anyway, I was writing songs and poetry and you know, I was just a book nerd, and it's just one of these weird, you know, Wednesday from you know, the Addams Family, that was me. It was like, you know, I couldn't be happy. I could only be an artist. So, you know, stay away. And it was just, you know, animals were my friends, and that was just that kind of kid. But art was a huge part of it. And then I started singing in bands and continuing to write. And then I came to LA, and that's my whole life.
And my understanding is that when you left to Texas, you're heading to Los Angeles, that your intent was to be a songwriter and not a performer. Do I have that right?
Yeah. I really didn't want to be center stage. It was not my intention. I loved singing with people and the, you know, the kind of camaraderie, and it came from singing in choirs and bands. And I wasn't interested in that. Wasn't my intent to, you know, be what I kind of became, I guess, but, you know, it just center stage and my name and whatnot. So yeah, that was my intent. And then I went around and got turned down by just a whole lot of record people and record companies, and with varying degrees of, cruelty it was, some people enjoyed saying no and that was a learning lesson. And then I had been singing on demos of songs I had written, and then people started reacting to my voice more than my songs, which was, you know, a little heartbreaking at the time. And so then I ended up, you know, singing on various things, and I met the Payne brothers, and they were trying to demo out a song. That was, it was just a demo for Warner Brothers for January Queer. And so that got signed like right away. So it was something that just kind of happened without me pursuing that, you know, exactly that course, you know, of reality. So I was kind of thrown into this. And so.
Well, here there are two things I want to interrupt, and I think we're moving past this, but I'm still pretty curious. When you said you started singing in choirs, was that religious choirs? Was that church or?
Well, no. This was in, I was never religious I wasn't raised religious. So I was pretty, you know, agnostic early on. I just, it was, you know, there were religious songs in school. And, which some of the most beautiful songs in the world are Christmas carols. So I had no problem singing these songs, and there's so much emotion in them. It was thrilling. You know, I could feel the emotion of what this was all about, you know, the Christmas. And I just didn't necessarily believe it, you know. I don't know, there's like a, you know, a I don't know, there was a disconnect, but I could feel what the songwriter felt, you know. That was in that, I loved that feeling, you know.
And so again, let me get this, so you're not raised in a very religious background, but you start you find an attraction singing in choirs.
Right.
And those choirs were like school choirs, or?
They were school choirs. I went to an all-girls school in Dallas, and they had some pretty advanced, I mean, it was kind of college level in the sixth grade and stuff. It was pretty, hardcore learning experience, and the music department was amazing. And so, you know, we were reading music and really young, and, in the sixth grade, you know, reading, you know, sight reading music. And and so there were some pretty elaborate productions, and I'd already had the taste of being on stage as a dancer, which I was felt so at home and comfortable in that world. So it was the same for singing, you know. I think I was anything to get away from myself. Like, it was that was my goal.
Anything to get away from yourself. Well, that's pretty interesting, right?
Okay, well, you weren't supposed to notice the darkness of that statement, but yeah, I had a very odd, strange, eerie childhood in some ways. And so,
well, you've already alluded to this sort of being Wednesday and the Addams Family thing. So there were elements of that were really present in your childhood.
Well, yeah, I had six fathers. And, so that was interesting, you know, and that was just a parade of stranger and stranger men, you know. So that was, that's what happened. And what they say, you know, and like, I'm at the point, I say I'm not religious, but I'm very spiritual. And I do think we learn what we need to learn and hopefully learn it. And I learned that, that's what made me a writer, you know, having a very confusing, childhood, let's say, that's what makes writers. And every great writer, I'm not saying I'm a great writer, by the way, but, you know, that they've had a horrible relationship with their father. And I had six horrible relationships, so this is perfect. So, but I guess a lot of writers are also like horrible alcoholics, which I was happy to skip that part of, you know, that formula. Uh-huh. But, things have reasons. Things have a reason to be in your life. And it can destroy you, or you can get stronger from it. And that's what I had to do.
Well, let's talk some about you getting stronger here. Now, you mentioned going out to LA and you meet the Payne's brothers, and you do the demo, Johnny, Are You Queer? And It comes out on Bomp Records initially. You get signed to Elektra, a couple albums come out. And then it's like about another 10 years before another album. I think it's Frightened by Nightingales. And then like another 10 years before another full length. Were you performing during those interludes between albums? And were you not actively pursuing music in that span of time?
Well, you know, I kept recording and I kept writing. And after I was dropped from Elektra, I recorded a whole record that we just released this year, because I put it in someone's garage, and then we remastered it and re-released it we've all lost 2 years, I think. Right. So it called Everything Is Oh Yeah, and that was supposed to be my, you know, third record on Elektra. And I worked, you know, with another producer and Hunt Sales for a while. I never lost my desire and need to do that. And I had started a recording studio with Geza X, who was my boyfriend at the time. And so he was doing a whole lot of production, and I just had access to a studio and I couldn't stop writing. So in some of the records that we re-released were recorded in those time periods, you know. So I can't say I ever stopped completely doing music, making music, but performing. Yeah, I was so turned off by the idea and the reality of the recording business and the industry. I got a few offers, to be signed and this and that. And I would just, it was just like waves of nausea. It was just like, no. It was like, you know, I would want to be heard. A musician wants to be heard, you know. And right. And so it was just like, but my psyche or something was just saying, no, you don't want to do that. I was not happy in that world, in the corporate world. And after Johnny Queer, I was attacked by, herds of hyenas, practically, just like trying, you know. That was, I stepped on a landmine on that one.
When you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you about that later on, but you're referring to the fact that not only were the sort of the right wingers going after you for doing a song like that, but there are also people like in the homosexual community who were very upset about that song. So you're kind of getting it from both ends.
It that was only on the East Coast that the gay community had a problem with, this straight, girl coming and asking, using the word that they weren't able to use, or, just interjecting myself in the conversation, I guess. And I, later on, I realized that was actually when AIDS was beginning. So they were dealing with a lot of things that their humor level was probably not, at its peak, and because there's a lot of humor in that song, and mainly because the girl is so clueless, like a bag of rocks. She just didn't know this guy was a flaming, gay person. And so, and it's funny, on the West Coast, it was an anthem for the gay community. And I've heard it so many times, I believe it. And I've had so many gay guys come up to me and tell me that was the song that gave them, allowed them to be gay and to come out. Like, tons of gay men have said this to me, which is kind of amazing. I was touched. I was, honored and to be a part of someone's, some people would play it for their parents. They play that song to let them know that they were gay, because they couldn't even say it out loud.
Wow. Well, so our coolest song in the world this week is Calling All Girls. It's off of Pussycat Babylon. And the album, now that is a reissue of the 2010 album. You'd mentioned reissuing records.
Right, okay. Right. But that was never released, it was never digitally released or on vinyl or CD. It was just digitally released, but it was a limited release and no one heard it, you know?
Yeah.
And a couple of songs got some traction in Europe, and that was really cool. Tiesto did a remix of one of the songs, and that's gotten millions of listens in Europe. And then you see the New Hong Kong actually went number one in Lithuania. So I don't know. That was thrilling. I'll have to go there someday because they loved it. But everything is happening in Europe. And so, you know, and I think it holds up. It's like the reason, you know, we kind of like got behind this again, to more than the other records really was just, it's electropop basically. And I think it holds up and that particular song, Calling All Girls, it had like a message. It's the most autobiographical record I ever did. And that's really heartfelt, you know, that message, you know, just to girls, you know, and because of my niece who was on a wrong track, and I could see her influences her choices and options were so limited, it's kind of my love letter to girls, you know, of an advice column, a twisted advice column, but with humor, but I was really trying to communicate something in that song. And so I thought, well, yeah, like let's let that be the one, so that's what happened. And now it's going to be the coolest song in the world. Like, that's fantastic.
It is, woman. It is the coolest song in the world. You know, in fact, I'm so happy that you were describing what the song, what's the inspiration for the song is, because there's a line in there about how Michael Myers was your boyfriend and how damaged you are. And then in an old interview I saw, you were talking about not having more than one boyfriend at a time, one nightmare at a time. That's how you phrased it, which I thought was pretty funny. But at the same time, I mean, that, you know, that's a relationship, things can be difficult enough as it is, and definitely had my sympathy with that. And then, but there's so much positivity in Calling All Girls, you know, a way to inspire women to sort of chart their own destinies, make the most of their lives, get beyond bad relationships. Right. Absolutely. And 2007 on your Invasion of the B-Girls album, you cover all sorts of really cool tracks from science fiction B-movies, including a favorite of mine, Maneaters, or maybe it's Maneaters.
Oh,
on
Mobile
And in the video for Calling All Girls, there's this definite love of sci-fi B-movies that comes through.
Absolutely.
When and where did you develop this love of such, cool things?
Well, okay. I told you I was like a reclusive, strange little girl, but one of the places in this world where I felt like so happy and this, you know, just enchanted, and that was science fiction movies. Like, really young, I just was just so swept away. It was like the perfect escape hatch, you know, for someone, you know, a child who didn't really want to be in this world in particular. And so that was where I just met adventure and strangeness and drama and spooky stuff and funny stuff. It was all combined, you know, and that was just an affinity I had for that world. And then kind of horror kind of came later, not horror like, you know, some of the really gruesome ones like, you know, Hostel and Saw. Like, I don't like it when it's too close, you know, to something that could happen actually. But I loved all of that. And then, you know, the B movies came along when I got a little older, and then, you know, and then someone turned me on to Russ Meyer, and that was complete, you know, just the whole universe just stood still for a second. When I saw Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, I went, what the fuck? You know, oh my God. And then I wrote a whole series, you know, like, well, they were re-reviews of the movies on that record. I don't know if you saw that when you were researching me, but the music, the songs and the movies, but I approached it more like a writer of trying to understand the history of what was going on. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, during the filming of Beyond the Valley of the Dolls, it's fascinating, you know, what was going on. And, at the time, and, but, you know, with, Faster Pussycat Kill Kill, that's a work of art. And that's before there were all these strict nudity, you know, like, you know, laws and rules. And it was very European. And it's in the museum of, in New York, there's a huge museum there. What is that? The Museum of...
Oh, I can't remember. I know what you're saying. Right.
It's considered, you know, like on a very high level. And and the music, you know, that song, you know, the one I did, Run Pussycat, right. and the musicianship of the songwriter. There's so many chords in those songs. You just like, I've had musicians go, no, I can't do it. Like, really good. Like, what is this? What have you done, Josie? And it was a movie I'd seen many times. It's when I was watching, you know, one of these science fiction, you know, Godzilla movies with Mothra and little Japanese twins. I'd seen it so many times, and I had a recording studio, and I was a musician then, you know, and I was older when I saw the movies, I thought, my God, I want to do all the theme songs in these movies that I love so much. And maybe I'll just do like a research and find new ones. And it just seemed like, you know, it was just the most amazing feeling to know that I could, now I had the means, you know, to do that. And, I was shocked that no one had ever done that before. I kept going, please, you're kidding me. When the publishers, they go, well, we've never heard of this before, you know, these, you know, odd movies. And I had to rent Godzilla's Roar, like from Japan and stuff.
Well, here, I'm going to interject this. Well, the sad part is our guitar player, Jeff Walls, passed away in 2019. Mm-hmm. But he had, the reason I bring this up is he had this band called Hillbilly Frankenstein in the early 90s. And they covered Man Eaters on Motorbikes.
Right.
And then also, just an incredibly cool guy, amazing musician. And you were mentioning Mothra and the two little twins. I can't think what their names are now, but he had a Mothra song, and his Mothra song was based on the seeing the girls sing in the movie. But this was all before, you know, the internet and all the clips being online. So his song was an approximation in his head of what that song was. And so they never released it as Hillbilly Frankenstein, but they did actually record, and that album never came out. And we later, as the Woggles, we did do a version of it. But he had a friend of his who was a linguist come up with these different syllables. So when the song has been played, people have said, oh, it must be Japanese, but it's not. It's just these nonsensical syllables, but done up in a way that it seems like it's a language.
No, it's amazing. That's the song that inspired me to do it. That exact song when the twins are singing to Mothra.
Mothra High or something. Mothra High. Summoning Mothra.
I sing it in Japanese on the record. And and when I got it translated, I did it phonetically, you know, but when I got it translated, like the lyrics were so incredible. Like, why are you crying, happiness? You know, it was just like, it was so beautiful. And so recently my friend in Tokyo, he started playing it in Japan, and I was like horrified. I was like, oh my God, my pronunciation must be horrible. And his wife, who's Japanese, asked him, how did I learn Japanese? Like she, I guess my phonetic, you know, translation was effective because she thought I knew Japanese, which is crazy. That just happened last year.
One more track I'll ask you about off the album, Stop Iggy Pop.
Yeah. Now,
have you ever met Iggy Pop?
No, my Paul has, my you know, partner. I'm his business wife. He is married, but
Now Paul is the guy that you have the studio with, is that right?
Yes,
Paul, what's his last name? Rosser?
Rossler. Yeah, he was in the Screamers and you know, 45 Grave and Twisted Roots, all the, you know, he's kind of a long career himself, but I've never met him, and it's going to be the B-side of a 12-inch single we're putting out on the of Calling All Girls with Style Iggy Pop on the B-side. So that's, you know, vinyl takes so long now, so it just it takes a second.
So you think that'll come out next year sometime?
Oh, it's going to come out in December, sometime this month, yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah, so I'm excited about that, and that, you know, I there's a story about that. It's about how that I wrote that song, but basically, you know, I just had music and the sounds that came out sounded like Stop Iggy Pop, you know. And so I had to create a whole world of why I would want to stop Iggy Pop. And so, you know, which was tricky to go backward in time to have, you know, but it's kind of one of my favorite songs on the record.
And, well, let me ask you about this Ukrainian Cowboy now single. That's the most recent single from 2019?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So growing up in Dallas, did your family have any cowboy roots or connections?
Oh, my granddad was a cowboy. When I wasn't in the ballet studio, I was on the ranch kind of roping, watching him rope while I herded, you know, cattle or calves or whatever. And
well, you can ride a horse then.
I can ride a horse. It was cowboys and ballet dancers. Like,
because like in the video, it shows you on a horse, but you can ride a horse.
I can ride a horse. I sure can.
Have you ever been to the Ukraine?
No, I have not. That was an accidental song title. You know, I had the song and there was no title. And Paul said, just tell me the title. I said, I don't have a title. And he'd already put, like, you know, polka music on there, and it was already, you know, Hole in My Soul as big as Russia. So it was going in that direction. And I said, oh, Ukrainian Cowboy. And that was before the whole Ukraine like blew up, like in the news and stuff.
Yeah.
And then I found out that there actually were Ukrainian cowboys. It's a whole like cultural thing over there. And so that was funny, but you know, that kind of stuck. And and Nikita, the ballet dancer, he was Yugoslavian. So, I mean, that part of the world, I was growing up around someone who was very Eastern European, and which is a very specific thing in this world.
So I've heard about mail order brides from Russia. Do you think there could be mail order husbands from the Ukraine? And would you get one?
Oh, my God. You know what? It would be tempting because they're very handsome, actually. not as a groom. That's the funniest question. Damn it! This got me off guard there. No.
No. I really love the, you know, a lot of your wordplay and your lyrics through all your songs. I really love, and that one, I like that you work in Prussia with Russia,
right.
Maybe
yeah,
Prussia.
Like, Hole in My Soul's biggest Russia, or maybe Prussia before the war, which to me was so funny because, I was trying to think, what rhymes with Russian? And it was just Prussian. I went, Prussia, fuck. And so then I started looking up the history of Prussia, you know, and it was just like, and they were part of Russia at some point. And so it's just like, I thought, well, that'd be funny. Maybe Prussia, because no one knows the difference. And then before the war, and it was, that was funny too, because there were so many wars. They never stopped with the wars. So it was just a lot of tongue in cheek stuff going on there that, that you noticed. I think a lot of people perhaps didn't notice, but I like stick things in there like that. That just make me laugh, you know? And,
well, I extra appreciate that because I'm half German. And so I was goose-stepping to that bit.
Oh, yeah. Well, Cold War Spy, then, is it's all about East Germany. It's about the Stasi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I saw you play recently in Los Angeles at the Zebulon Cafe. I know you were doing some other dates this fall, including Cafe 9, really cool small place in New Haven, Connecticut.
So you had
a good time there. Did you have a good time there, Cafe 9?
Oh, it was fantastic. It was so good. And the whole tour was incredible. And but Cafe 9, I love that town, New Haven, and they were so nice to us there. And you know, the audience was great. And New York City was amazing too. TVI and Chicago was really great. And I don't know, I love the East Coast. I really do love it.
Well, I know that Melanie Vammen from the Pandoras is in your current band, and she's a sweetheart. Who else is playing with you right now in the band?
Well, I have kind of two different bands. I have I have an East Coast band, and I have my West Coast band. I didn't plan it like that. It was kind of through necessity, but I have Marcus Watkins, a guitar player, and he's amazing. He had a band called I'll think of it, but anyway, he's just a markedly amazing virtuoso on the guitar, and Paul Rossler was playing keyboard with me, and Melanie's on keyboard, and Cherish Alexander, she's my bass player, and she does all our graphic arts for Kitten Robot too. And, you know, just a really, and Charlie, you know, Charlie, I had never met before, but the drummer, and he came in. And on the East Coast, it's Travis Rahman, who produced this Go-Go's tribute record. Melanie and I, and then Cherish was playing with us, and Dave Russ, drums. I'll just say the whole name of the band. So they're all great, you know. Then the male drummers could sing harmony, all both of them, and that's kind of amazing.
And I was going to ask you something here. I was thinking, it was something about tying it back to Pussycat Babylon. Well, let me ask you about this instead. So do you have any tour dates lined up for next year, for 2022 yet?
Well, right now we have this, you know, I started a couple years ago doing these 80 shows, and I managed to avoid them all this time. I didn't want to play 80s music, honestly. I just really wanted to move on. And then I asked to do a show that Johnny Lydon was going to be in. And I was like, okay, I've got to do this, you know, this festival. So I learned all these 80s songs again, and I kind of fell back in love with the songs, which was crazy. So, so these 80s shows we have, they're called Ladies of the 80s, where it's just four bands and all female fronted bands, like Missing Persons and Bow Wow Wow and Stacy Q and me, and so that's really fun. We sing the tracks, but you know, Melanie and Cherish and me are playing live. We just basically playing two drums and guitar. So it's very fun, and we just did some.
And the tour is called Ladies of the 80s.
Yeah, we're doing House of Blues at the beginning of January in Vegas, and then. And the House of Blues in Anaheim in the end of January. And, you know, I'm just trying to keep my options open. I'm supposed to go to Japan to host this indie video award show. And I'm a judge or something crazy like that.
That's but great.
I don't know if I don't know if Japan's going to be opened up by May. They're having having a hard time over there, and I'm dying to go to Tokyo and all of Japan, really. So I mean, that's kind of it. I'm trying to put together a you know, Northwest tour of, you know, Oregon and Seattle and Vancouver and San Francisco again, and because I keep getting requests for that part of the world to go.
Oh, yeah.
There.
You need to get back.
Yeah.
That thing I was trying to remember a moment ago was a Kitten Robot. You mentioned Kitten Robot is
talking,
and that is your record label. So Pussycat Babylon.
Okay. Yeah. And that's also our studio name. It's they're connected. All our artists record at our studio.
Well, I want us to talk about the track we're going to go out on a moment. Everything is Oh Yeah. But one last thing was that I just saw some clip of you singing Secret Agent Man being backed by the Ventures. I don't know where this clip was from. When was that? Do you recall?
That was like in 80. That's when I was recording the second record on Elektra. It was like 1984 or something. And that was wild. Of course, it wasn't in my key. It was really hard to sing. I had no rehearsals with them. I just say, like, okay, you know, now start singing. And with no rehearsal when they're filming it, like, okay.
Well, you know, I'm not surprised those guys, you know, were not the, since they're an instrumental band, of course, it may not even occur to them, you know.
Have a singer. Yeah, right. And I'm in there. The daughter of one of the Ventures, she just produced and directed this documentary about the Ventures like last year, and I'm in that. They interview me for that, which is kind of funny. And
when did you come aware of the Ventures? Was that something from the early 60s, or was that something you came to later on when you were like,
the mid 60s, you know, when they were, when they had, they had a hit on AM radio in Dallas,
right.
Texas, you know, Pipeline or some stuff. But, you know, I always try and research things. And when I knew I was going to be on this documentary, I researched, you know, the Ventures a little bit, and I didn't realize they had made so many records. I mean, it's insane the amount of records they made. It was like 50 records, all different styles. And that was so cool because I could relate to wanting to do different styles.
Have you ever seen the albums? It's like How to Play or Learn to Play Guitar with the Ventures.
I haven't seen that one.
Oh, yeah. You have. Look for that. You know, so the B-52s, I can't think of what the late guitar player's name is, but he was a big Ventures fan, and he learned playing guitar to the Ventures records.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Well, I could definitely get better on the guitar. I might have to check that out.
Yeah. Well, we can take a listen to one more track off of Pussycat Babylon now, and I'd like us to hear Everything is Oh Yeah. And now this is kind of a confusing song to me because it's on Pussycat Babylon, but this was also the song that was going to serve as a title track for your third album on Elektra back in the 80s, and then out in 2019. What's the story on this tune?
It's on it's an old song of mine, and it did come out on the record Everything is Oh Yeah. You know, that was supposed to be my third record, but we didn't release it till just recently. But when I did Pussycat Babylon, Paul kind of reproduced it, and mm-hmm. Kira Rossler's playing bass on there, and which is pretty damn cool, and because her playing is so amazing, and I'm playing keyboard on it, and Paul's playing on it, and Paul, you know, changed some of the chords around. It's the same song, but it's just a lot more modern of a version of it. It's a lot less, you know, poppy and more rocky, I guess you could say.
And you like it better, or is it just different?
It depends on what mood I'm in. I mean, there's something very innocent about the original one. And once again, it's like it was heartfelt. It's what I really believe, you know. It's Buddhism basically, and so I still believe that. And just so yeah, that's it's just a little more aggressive. It's aggressive Buddhism, you could say, but I won't say that because that's ridiculous. But I'm in the mood to like this one right now.
Well, very cool. And Josie, I want to thank you so much for chatting with me today on our Coolest Conversations.
Well, it was really a pleasure, Manfred. Thank you so much for having me. I'm honored to be included in this group of bands, the coolest bands in the world for
As promised. As promised, here's Everything Is Oh Yeah off the re-release Pussycat Babylon. It's Josie Cotton and Little Steven's Underground Garage. That was Josie Cotton here in Little Steven's Underground Garage with some of her song, Everything Is Oh Yeah, which is off of her recently reissued album, Pussycat Babylon. This is the Mighty Manfred, and thanks again to Josie for speaking with me on our Coolest Conversations. Thanks also to Sammy Semenza for producing our podcast. Next time, our guest will be singer-songwriter Patricia Vaughn, who the New York Times has called the Renaissance Woman of Austin, Texas. She's got a new Christmas album out called My Favorite Holiday. We'll talk all about it next time around on your Coolest Conversations podcast presented by Hard Rock and Little Steven's Underground Garage.
In the mid-50s, two men knocked over a kerosene stove during a fight at a concert. After fleeing the blaze, the guitar player realized he left his beloved Gibson inside. B.B. King then ran in and saved it. He later learned that the fight was over a woman named Lucille, and ever since, his guitars have borne that name. You can find Lucille at the Hard Rock in Hollywood, Florida. Thousands of other priceless pieces of rock history can be found at Hard Rock cafes, casinos, and hotels around the world. To learn more, visit hardrock.com.